The following is a production of Alabama Public Radio News. Have you ever wondered where your water comes from? It's Sunday afternoon on Lake Guntersville. It's 95 degrees outside, and Douglas Webster is calling it a day.
It was okay. It's a little slow. Still, the fry, we're finding fry around the piers.
And if you don't know what a fry is...
baby bass.
Webster's a bass fisherman. That's where all the lingo comes from. While Webster secures his bass boat, Braulio Pedroso is just now dropping his fishing hook into the water.
Oh, I just came in about 5 minutes ago, and it started to bite already. So I bet it would be good as soon as the sun goes down a little bit.
But Pedroso isn't interested in catching bass. He's sitting on a wooden dock with his back to all the boats out on the lake today. Pedroso is fishing for crappies.
Crappie is the best. Good eating for everybody. The kids, when you fillet them, it's white meat and tasty.
For Braulio Pedroso and Douglas Webster, Lake Guntersville is a fishing hole. For cities like Muscle Shoals, Florence, Decatur, and Huntsville, there's a more basic need. And filling that need can get loud. Lake Guntersville is part of the Tennessee River, which is a primary source of drinking water in North Alabama. This pumping station draws water from the Tennessee for residents of Huntsville.
Today we're pumping a little over 25 million gallons a day through this plant alone.
Gary Bailey works for Huntsville Utilities. He says demand is so predictable, you can set your watch to it.
The peak times are early in the morning, and they're on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday.
And Bailey says it's not due to this. Or this. But rather, this.
And every sprinkler guy sets the sprinklers up for Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and they set them all up for the same time, so... those are our really days that we get hit the hardest, are Monday, Wednesday, Friday in the morning.
Four turbines pull water from the Tennessee River. From here, it travels 4 miles through 60-inch pipes that date back to the 1960s. The first stop is here at Huntsville's South Parkway Water Treatment Plant. It sits behind a locked security gate just south of town. Chlorine and other chemicals are added to remove bacteria and pollutants. Ben Brewer says the next step is a series of filters.
These filters will trap anything 0.45 microns or larger. And all the bacteria is larger than 0.45 microns.
But it's not just bacteria that concerns environmentalists. There are two coal-fired power plants on the Tennessee River, one to the east side of the state, one to the west. That raises the worry of chemicals like arsenic and mercury getting into the water supply. Critics say when there's a risk of water contamination, poor and rural communities are usually hit the hardest. APR's Alex Aubuchon looked into how efforts to resolve a concern over coal ash may wind up hurting one town.
There's a welcome sign at the city limits of Uniontown, Alabama. It reads, "It's a nice place to live." This community is in the heart of the state's impoverished Black Belt region. Along with the local Dollar General, the feed store, and the town auto shop, residents of Uniontown say they have a coal ash problem.
Oh, it smells a foggy smell. It smells really disgusting.
Esther Calhoun has lived in Uniontown for 20 years.
I smelled it about 3 weeks ago when we went out to the landfill, and it makes you gag. I mean, it really literally makes you sick.
Calhoun is referring to the Arrowhead landfill just outside town, and she's not the only one complaining.
I was thinking I was moving to a quiet, safe environment.
Uniontown resident Ben Eaton is a retired school teacher.
And to face this, we have a number of problems that need to be taken care of. The landfill is one of its top priority.
I woke up this morning with my mind.
The Arrowhead landfill brought Uniontown residents together for a community meeting. Esther Calhoun organized the event for the group Black Belt Citizens Fight for Health and Justice. She says supporters of the landfill promised good-paying jobs, and that happened, but only for a little while.
But the thing about it, if you talk to some of them now, they really hate it because they didn't really know what it was doing to the community. They didn't really know they was getting money, you know, big money, because, you know, $1,000 a week is a lot of money. And those thought about it. Now the job didn't last very long. It was enough to plant it and go.
The situation took another turn almost 7 years ago.
People in Roan County, Tennessee, still aren't sure this evening just how bad a disaster they are facing after a coal ash spill that has covered neighborhoods and choked local rivers. Millions of tons.
5 million tons of coal ash spilled after a dam ruptured in Kingston, Tennessee. It was called the worst spill of its type in history. The hazard posed by coal ash takes a little explaining. Coal ash is the byproduct of coal-fired power plants. It contains chemicals like mercury, cadmium, and arsenic.
When you put coal ash in water, contaminants will be easily leached out from the coal ash into the water.
Dr. Avner Vingosh specializes in coal ash pollution at Duke University.
If you have effluent in coal ash pond, those effluent could be enriched in those contaminants.
Tennessee's problem became Uniontown's when millions of tons of coal ash was stored at the Arrowhead landfill.
It was dumped right in the black community, right in front of their homes. That was terrifying.
Esther Calhoun.
Because my neighbor, she lived right there, and she was an older lady. She was like 72. And she would sit on that porch, and she was terrified just looking at it.
The owners of the Arrowhead landfill say the facility has a system of liners underneath and vegetative cover on top to keep the chemicals contained. They also claim it's tested regularly to make sure everything is safe. The Kingston spill in Tennessee isn't the only possible source of coal ash that has environmentalists worried. What you're hearing now are the generators at the Gorgas steam plant just north of Birmingham. It's one of 9 coal-fired power plants at work across the length and breadth of the state. Nationwide, plants like these produce a reported 150 million tons of coal ash each year. Avner Vingosh.
So what we have in the U.S. is a situation that we are protecting the sky because of preventing emission of metals and contaminants to the atmosphere. But at the same time, the level of contaminants in coal ash is being further concentrated.
Vingosh is far from the only person concerned about coal ash.
We have over 44 coal ash ponds across the state.
Adam Johnston is with the environmental group Alabama Rivers Alliance.
Some of them are really close to drinking water supplies. And in the case of Gadsden, Alabama, there's a coal ash pond 0.8 miles upstream of the drinking water intake for that entire community.
APR News asked Alabama Power on a number of occasions to comment on the coal ash situation. The utility declined a recorded interview, but off tape, Alabama Power says other forms of pollution, like stormwater runoff, do more harm. The utility also insists that they monitor their coal ash along with state and federal inspectors. But Vingosh says there's a hole in those policies.
Each of the coal ash pond has what we call outfall, which is regulated by the state with respect to the volume of effluent that are allowed to be discharged from the coal ash pond into the rivers or lakes that associate with those coal ash ponds. However, the level of contaminants in those effluents in the outfalls are not regulated.
Back at the Uniontown meeting, residents talk about what life here was like before the Kingston coal ash arrived and what it's like now. Calhoun recalls dropping by one of her neighbors.
When I would go down there and visit, I couldn't even sit out there, you know, in the yard, you know. Because, you know, mostly when you live in the country, you sit on the porch, you have a garden. She used to have a little garden right in front of her house. All that stuff changed.
Regulations are finally catching up. Just last month, the EPA imposed strict limits on the amount of toxic chemicals that can be released from ash ponds into waterways. Those caps will take effect in the next 5 years. In response, both the TVA and Alabama Power say they plan to eventually close their ash ponds, and power companies across the country are expected to follow suit. The catch for communities like Uniontown is that the use of coal is expected to remain steady, and all that ash still has to go somewhere. On the top of the list is landfills, just like Arrowhead Landfill, which is already advertising itself to companies nationwide as the perfect place to send coal ash. So for Ben Eaton, Esther Calhoun, and all the residents of Uniontown, things may get a lot worse before they get better.
Back on the road to find out where your water comes from, we move from the Tennessee River in North Alabama to cities like Tuscaloosa and Birmingham in the central part of the state. These communities rely on water from the Black Warrior River Basin. A series of locks and dams was put in to create Lake Tuscaloosa. Residents here drink the water from the lake while coal barges carry cargo down the river to the Gulf of Mexico. This arrangement doesn't make everybody happy.
Well, the smell is similar to a sewer.
That's Penny Bailey. She's visiting Tuscaloosa from North Carolina on business.
The water color is a brown color, and it is, you see pollution. You see, actually, as we're standing here talking, we can see the current moving, and we can see trash in the water.
Bailey isn't an environmentalist or a hydrologist, but her line of work gives her the chance to see bodies of water across the country up close.
We have alignment. Are you ready? Attention, please.
Bailing is aboard a dragon boat.
Get out of the boat if you're soft. Come on.
Well, I tell them if you can imagine a stretched out canoe, which is holds 20 paddlers, a drummer, and a steers person, and they all have to synchronize and work together. That's pretty much what a dragon boat is.
Let's go.
Bailing's company goes from state to state holding dragon boat races to raise money for local charities. The Tuscaloosa Junior League is sponsoring this event on the Black Warrior. Bailing says it's easy to see when a lake or river is healthy and when it's not.
The cleanest water I've ever been in and worked a race was in Montana, where you can see all the way to the bottom. It's so clear that you can see the rocks on the bottom of the lake.
It's not just homeowners who rely on water from the Black Warrior and its tributaries, but businesses as well. We're at the Black Warrior Brewery in Tuscaloosa. Long before customers belly up to the bar, co-owner Jason Spikes goes to work in the back.
In the brewing process, I basically want to rinse, run water through my grain to try to get all the sugars I can out of it.
Spikes is standing on a 10-foot-high platform, water hose in hand. It takes almost 800 gallons of water from Lake Tuscaloosa to clean his stainless steel brewing tanks and make his latest batch of beer. Spikes admits his livelihood depends on keeping Lake Tuscaloosa and the Black Warrior clean, and tonight he's ready to put his money where his water is.
20% of our beer sales are going to go to the Riverkeeper, and we also have donation jars set up here.
And if you want to know what a Riverkeeper does, just go to the bar. Nelson Brook just ordered, and he has a specific flavor in mind.
Lock 17, as it's affectionately known, is the lock next to Bankhead Dam, which is the northernmost major dam on the Black Warrior River. And, I hadn't had it before.
Brooke is the Black Warrior River Keeper. He's the head of a nonprofit environmental group whose sole purpose is to protect the river from pollution and overdevelopment. Brooke says he hopes that's the message people take home tonight.
Well, hopefully they're going to take away the connection. And also, if they didn't know what the source of their drinking water is, which is also the source of the water for this beer, they'll go home knowing that.
Brooke is just one riverkeeper in Alabama. There's one for the Tennessee River, the Coosa River, and so on. In matters of water quality, these groups are typically on one side of the issue and state regulators on the other. Alabama's water war with Florida and Georgia has prompted a do-it-yourself alternative to help people being hurt in the process. APR's Mackenzie Bates explains.
It's 5:30 in the morning at the East Point Working Waterfront in Apalachicola, Florida.
Get my gas, get my ice, get my few drinks, and then I head on out there to Cat Point, try to find some oysters to catch.
Dwayne Topham is getting ready to hit the water. Business used to be good. At one point, Topham was catching 30 bags of freshwater oysters, but not now.
Three bags, 360-pound bushels, where we used to catch 30 60-pound bushels. I've been losing every damn thing I got. Captain goes down with the ship, though.
Topham and other freshwater oyster farmers say they feel like a bone in a three-dog fight.
New at noon, two big Supreme Court rulings. The first one is a huge victory for Georgia in the tri-state water war over Lake...
Alabama, Georgia, and Florida have been fighting over the Apalachicola, Chattahoochee, and Flint River system for 25 years. They cannot decide on how to share the water.
We got involved in it because we felt like there was a better way to manage it, so we had a consistent flow of water coming down the river.
That's Betty Webb, the chair of the Apalachicola Chattahoochee Flint Stakeholders Group. She, along with 55 other members from the three states, decided to take matters into their own hands.
They decided to try to get this organization together of these members throughout the basin to come together to try to do a negotiated effort to figure out the best way for everyone to share the water that we have available.
The committee includes people who depend on river water, like developers, utilities, and the tourism and fishing industries. The general idea is everyone gets a vote on how to use the water and everyone gets a veto. Webb says every need is important to all three states, and it's also critical that all three get the water they need to keep their economies thriving.
Alabama is one of the ones that's really suffering because we need it to be consistent. We need to figure out the best way to keep it as consistent as possible.
Basically, Webb's complaint is that state government is not getting the job done. For the oyster fishermen, the water flowing into Apalachicola Bay needs to be managed. Too much stormwater runoff from showers like this, or too much river pollution, can kill the oyster beds. For environmentalists, the problem goes beyond squabbles between the governors of Alabama, Georgia, and Florida. In Montgomery, at the Alabama Department of Emergency Management Office, concerned citizens and riverkeepers attend the triennial review of the water quality standards.
We don't want Alabama to turn into a California, where there is conflicts over water.
That's Mitch Reed, the program director of the Alabama Rivers Alliance.
We have too much of this God-given resource for us to squander it without having good policy.
Reed is part of an organization to help keep the state's rivers healthy and thriving. His gripe today is on the lack of water management at the state level, and he's no fan of the Alabama Department of Environmental Management.
There are real problems with sewage treatment plants in Alabama. We have 284 plants in the state, and only 19 have been in full compliance over the last 3 years.
Reed considers ADEM the poster child of Alabama's political water problems, but not everybody sees it that way.
We do not have regulatory authority over water quantity, except to the degree that reduced flows may impact water quality.
That's Lance LaFleur. He's head of Alabama's Department of Environmental Management. Environmentalists often paint the agency as the bad guy in Alabama's water woes. LaFleur feels like he's caught in the middle. The big complaint is the lack of money to do his job.
If we are to maintain our level of service and our workload, then we have to make up for that funding that's been reduced by some other form. And the only form available to us is our permit fees that the regulated industries pay.
The agency has increased permit fees for industries twice. It could likely go higher for the third straight year. Officials are going to ask for an increase of 20% at a meeting later this year. That's on top of a 50% hike 2 years ago. The Alabama legislature added to the drama this year with a proposal to zero out funding for LaFleur's agency. And so it goes on.
What's that?
We need that war.
Back in Apalachicola, oyster fisherman Horace Harris feels like he's caught in the political tug of war.
We're not asking for it to make our water look pretty. We ask for it to make our oysters produce better. So we can have a harvest so that when y'all want to sit down and watch this Florida and Georgia game and eat some Apalachicola oysters, thank me for one.
And the haggling goes on over the Chattahoochee River. Residents of Georgia drink the water from it. Alabama gets electric power from it. And for people like Horace Harris, it's all about the seafood.
You need me to go to your gas pumps. You know what I'm saying? You need me to go out there. You need me. If I go out there and make $500, guess what? You need me to spend every motherfucking dime of it.
Time appears to be running out this season for Harris to make his living in Florida's oyster beds.
As we continue our road trip around Alabama to find where your drinking water comes from, there's a dividing line around Montgomery. About 60% of Alabamians get their drinking water from rivers. The remaining 40% have to drill for it.
Groundwater is underneath the land surface, so it's sort of out of sight and out of mind.
Marlon Cook is with the Alabama Geological Survey. He leads the team that finds new sources of groundwater like this one near Selma. That job often means a lot of hiking.
Okay, so this rest stop, you know, it was like most rest stops. It had a visitor center and a parking lot. And
we're on Highway 231 near Montgomery. Cook leads the way to an abandoned concrete slab, which used to be a bustling rest stop.
The well is still here, so we were able to save the well. be able to use.
Cook and his team used the rest stop's old water well to test quality and quantity for surrounding well fields that serve the Montgomery area. These wells are maybe 1,000 feet or so deep. If you want to see the deepest well in Alabama, you need to know someone with the right set of keys. Cook and I are in the town of Ozark between Troy and Dothan. Their well reaches over 3,000 feet below ground. When their water comes to the surface, it's over 100 degrees. The town is happy with their system, but Marlon Cook is worried.
I'm holding a hydrograph, which is a graphical depiction of continuous water levels over a long period of time.
A hydrograph is a white map with black squiggles. The squiggles go up and down across the page to show rainfall that fills up wells like Ozark's. It's called water recharge. The low squiggles mean...
that is the dry season where we have very minimal recharge in our aquifer.
And the high squiggles?
The peak is the peak of the recharge season, which normally occurs in the spring during our wet season.
This is why Cook is worried. The high squiggle for 2015 springtime rainy season is half the size of the squiggle for 2014's rainy season. Cook says that could mean a drought within weeks.
For the fall, our stream levels, habitats, things that are dependent on plentiful rainfall, there could be a concern for the coming fall and then into next spring.
The big worry is the peanut farms around Dothan. Still, the southern third of Alabama depends on well water to live. That includes cities like Montgomery, Dothan, and Troy, as well as Baldwin County. There's just one big exception in that part of the state. About 10 miles west of Mobile sits Big Creek Lake. It covers 5.5 square miles and is the primary source of drinking water for the city. The process may sound familiar by now. A series of 8 turbines pumps around 65 million gallons of water out of the lake every day. It travels through 60-inch pipes roughly 4 miles to treatment plants for distribution. The last stop on our trip around the state is a study in contrasts. Big Creek Lake is west of Mobile. On the east side is Mobile Bay. Seagulls here compete for food in the marshy areas near Interstate 10 and U.S. Highway 90. People don't drink the water out of the bay, but there are environmental concerns. At the north end of the bay, far from the noise of traffic, is Five Rivers Delta. The Mobile, the Spanish, the Tensaw, the Apalachee, and the Blakely Rivers all empty at one point into Mobile Bay. 14% of all the fresh water in the nation flows into the bay here.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people don't realize that.
Stephen Carey teaches biology at the University of Mobile.
They don't realize the size of this drainage basin that we have here. It's the fourth largest in terms of discharge coming through here.
One catch is those five rivers also deliver pollution from 3 states.
Oh, North Alabama, parts of Georgia, and even in North Mississippi.
When it comes to the condition of Mobile Bay, we thought we'd ask a familiar face.
Here we go. We have alignment. Are you ready? Attention, please. 1, 2.
Penny Bailing and her fleet of dragon boats made their way from the Black Warrior River and Tuscaloosa to a fundraiser here at Five Rivers Delta.
When you look down in the water, you can kind of not quite see the bottom, but you can see a lot farther down than you can in the Black Warrior, for example.
Despite the assessment, Stephen Carey remains worried. He knows people who've lived along Mobile Bay for decades, and they see the difference development has made. We've spent a lot of time looking at where your water comes from. Now, APR Stan Ingold looks at where it goes and how Mobile Bay in particular faces the consequences.
When it rains in Tuscaloosa and Huntsville, things like erosion and a threat to wildlife may not cross your mind. For people living along the Gulf Coast, though, it's a different story. Rainwater that falls in the central and northern parts of the state typically travels south. And the Mobile area is as south as you can get in Alabama.
If it rains a bunch in North Alabama or anywhere upstream, we end up closing oyster beds for harvesting.
Casey Calloway holds the title of Mobile Baykeeper. She heads a nonprofit group that tries to protect the environment around the bay.
We close shrimping. We close seafood from being harvested, which is a huge economic driver for our community as well.
That makes stormwater runoff public enemy number one for marine life in and around the bay.
Every flush and every big rainstorm and every event that happens upstream impacts us down here.
Mobile Baykeeper works to help maintain living shorelines like this one in Helenwood Park on the way to Dauphin Island. This is where we find Baykeeper's program director, Jason Kadulis. As he suits up to walk through and check the oyster bed, Kadulis explains the purpose of the concrete rings poking out just above the surface of the water.
What we're looking at here is where they put some construction materials out as part of the restoration project. And this has a couple of benefits. One is it's going to slow the wave action. It's going to allow that natural marsh to regenerate.
The other benefit is that it will act as an artificial reef for critters living in the marsh areas. And there's a lot of life around here.
We could walk over to the water's edge and look for blue crabs. I've noticed some school of mullets here this morning, several bird species. We've got some night heron, some great egret. There's an osprey platform over there that seems to be active. It was flying overhead not too long ago.
Mobile Baykeeper isn't the only group in town looking after the area around the bay. The Mobile Bay National Estuary Program was started with amendments to the Clean Water Act in 1987. Roberta Swan is the agency's director. She says the Mobile Bay watershed covers much of the state.
If you could imagine an upside-down Christmas tree laid over the state of Alabama, all of that water that's covered by that upside-down Christmas tree at the tip of the tree is Mobile Bay.
That's where Thompson Engineering comes in. When runoff was causing problems in the towns of Spanish Fort and Daphne, they were called in to do something about it. One area leading to a tributary known as Joe's Branch was impacted by years of development from a nearby subdivision.
Urban development affects runoff. Volume of runoff is larger, the velocity's larger, and the streams just can't take it.
That's Emery Baya, an environmental engineer and vice president of Thompson Engineering. He says this site was particularly bad.
Where we're standing right now, which is the head of this restoration project, was about a 30-foot deep gully, is what it looked like. And this whole channel that we're looking down was a severely eroded channel.
Baya says the soil flushed from this area eventually made it to Mobile Bay, where it will impact coastal life. But there was another immediate concern for the surrounding area.
We're right south of Highway 31. It's hard to see right now, but to our south is Westminster Village Retirement Community. And this erosion not only was an environmental problem, but it was threatening the roadway and it was threatening the residences.
Baez says they built a type of speed bump and filter system to fix the problem.
Stormwater comes from north of here across Highway 31, flows under a culvert that comes into this pool that we're standing above, and it goes down. There's a series of rock weirs that basically, as it flows over those weirs, dissipates energy, and the erosion's been controlled.
Efforts like this require collaborations between communities. Since watersheds do not follow political boundaries, sometimes cities have to work together.
Spanish Fort and Daphne have two great mayors. They're working together.
Ashley Campbell is the Environmental Programs Manager for the City of Daphne.
You can't point fingers. Water flows downhill, so you're inheriting an issue that's occurred over time. So you can't say, well, they did it, or she did it, he did it. So what you have to do is you have to come together.
Efforts continue on extending the work done at Joe's Branch with the hope that projects like these will continue to help keep the land where it is now and out of the bay.
If you'd like to hear more of Alabama Public Radio's coverage on the condition of our state's water supply and the health of its rivers, just go to APR.org. I'm Pat Duggins. For Stan Ingold, Alex Aubuchon, Mackenzie Bates, and all of us at Alabama Public Radio, thanks for tuning in, and good night.